One aim of the Cultures of Consumption program, which sponsors research and public discussions like these, is to advance our understanding of consumption by seeing them from a comparative and global perspective, as well as from within a British context. The information packs, which you picked up in on your way in, or if not, you can pick them up on your way out at the registration desk, will give you a short overview of some of the rich research conducted by colleagues in the program. I'm Frank Trentman of Birkbeck College, director, and I'm delighted to welcome you to the first in this year's cycle of public events, which will bring together international and British perspectives. Few subjects in recent years have generated such heated debate and concern in many countries as the expansion of consumer credit and personal indebtedness. I'm therefore very pleased to introduce our speaker this evening, Robert Manning. Professor Manning is a leading American expert and advocate on questions of consumer credit. He's the author of the prize-winning Credit Card Nation, amongst many other publications, has given evidence to U.S. Congress, and indeed is currently advising some of the leading Democratic presidential candidates. After the lecture, discussion will be kicked off by two experts from Britain who will give short comments. Anna Bradley, who is currently Consumer Director at the Financial Services Authority, and before that was at the National Consumer Council, and Orazio Attanasio, Professor of Economics at UCL and also at the Institute of Fiscal Studies. After that, there will be time for questions and discussion from the floor, and after that, you're all very much invited to a small drinks reception. Ladies and gentlemen, Robert Manning on the power of plastic, banking deregulation, and the rise of the credit card nation.
Well, thank you very much. Can everyone hear me? Certainly want to thank Dr. Trentman as director of the Cultures of Consumption program and Assistant Stephanie Nixon. As you'll see, logistically, this is a presentation that's a bit of a challenge. Also want to thank my wife, Anita Butera, who's been putting up with a lot of cross-national and international trips, and as an EU citizen, constantly reminds me of European conflicted attitudes towards American encroachment on issues such as consumer credit and debt. What I want to do today is to briefly, keep in mind I'm used to teaching four-hour seminars, so I'm reduced to 40 minutes. I want to show how a tremendous transformation in consumer attitudes has occurred in a relatively brief period of time. So from a historical perspective, I want to show what has changed in a relatively brief period of time. The role of structural change, both in the United States and globally, in particular looking at the emergence of the dominant regime of neoliberalism and how it's impacted both the deregulation of consumer financial services in the United States, how it's tremendously changed financial services both in terms of consolidation and the new organizational form of conglomeration highlighted by the Citibank Travelers Group merger, and then go more specifically about some of the issues in regard to the use of consumer credit and debt from a consumer's perspective. And then I want to conclude by presenting, interspersed throughout the presentation, some of the important parallels of the U.S. experience as it impacts both the U.K. as well as Europe. And so in conclusion then, I think most of you have the handouts that I had assembled on some rather rough trends on what is very clear, the stark and dramatic increase of consumer credit and debt in Europe today. Also want to put it in perspective. Basically, I have a three-book project. The first one was Credit Card Nation, to understand many of the rough contours about the social impact of this profound change in terms of the allocation and cost of consumer credit. The next project I'm working on now is the specific impact of what I've called generation in debt, of how, both at a national level, which we can talk about briefly, the shifting balance of power away from state management of banks at a macroeconomic level to private allocation of consumer credit and its implication in terms of opportunities, both in terms of the ability to manage economic growth and decline within a country, as well as the ability of households to address volatility in terms of their own personal situations. And the final component is this credit card world project, where I'm looking at how neoliberalism is fostering the global expansion of financial services and how we're actually seeing, through the tremendous emphasis of global trade, the emergence now of new regimes based on both production and consumption in developing countries, but also its implications in terms of civic engagement. I'm particularly thinking about Southeast Asia and China. So let me just begin with a quote from a very influential book at the turn of the century in the United States. And the emphasis here, in terms of the moral connotations and religious attitudes, is the negative connotation of debt in America, particularly references to the devil and the purity of one individually having the discretion to manage one's household debts effectively, so that those people who are in debt are implied to somehow have personal flaws, and that those who have somehow stayed out of debt have demonstrated their worthiness, and in some cases in Calvinist culture and religious sects, the emphasis is on accumulating wealth and demonstrating one's ability to discipline the temptations of participating in a consumer society. Also keep in mind, as we go through this brief historical odyssey, we're talking about a transition from a culture of scarcity of 200 years ago to now a whole different scenario and framework of the culture of abundance, and how the shift in terms of economic prosperity is from manufacturing now to consumption. Indeed, how often do we see advertisements in the glorification of consumption today, where the use of cash now is seen as an anachronism? I want to show this one example. This is a film that I was using, and some of you might have seen some of the attention on my work. Can we get the sound up of the expansion of consumer credit to young people? And I use this as an example of the lexicon changes, where we now have situations where you're not in financial situation of difficulty as long as you have access to credit. And that's what the first section that I want to address is how dramatic we've gone through this transition of one's worthiness towards credit and the social implications of debt. In particular, as we traverse generationally, looking at whether one is entitled to credit versus whether one earns credit. And that gets us into this situation of evaluating the worthy versus the unworthy creditors. And I want to show this particular scene to start off as we get to the core of the role of the consumer in our society. This is a scene from Spike Lee's movie of Moment of Blues. And I use this as an example of how consumer credit and debt in the form of plastic is both a social status item, but it also is an opportunity of enhancing one's position in society through consumption, but also here's the negative side of when the credit card isn't accepted.
Jungle. Let me package you up in one of these CDs here. Put you in my pocket. Up front. Kiss on you.
Shadow?
Clark.
Your account has declined. I have to confiscate your card.
Wait a minute. I just paid that mother. Call him back.
Just look right there.
All flash, no cash. This is really a critical advance in terms of the nature of status and stratification in society today, because now access to consumer credit has in many ways obscured and mediated distinctions in terms of access to financial services and products, etc. Today, you can afford an Armani suit on a credit card even if your income only permits you to live in a prefabricated housing unit. So the starting point to understand our transformation and how profound it is in the United States, based on early Puritan founders, Benjamin Franklin, the emphasis of a penny saved is a penny earned, focusing on frugality, emphasizing the imperative of accumulating versus consuming. This is the only graphic in the first part of my book, which, by the way, the credit card industry would not give me any permission to include any advertisements, and that's why I really enjoyed having the opportunity for these presentations, because there's nothing they can do about it. This is an 1870 lithograph, and I show this to emphasize how profound the change is. Notice the person, the merchant here, who says, "I give credit," and through the window there's a sign that says, "To the poorhouse." And the new way is, "I sell only for cash," emphasizing the affluence of that particular merchant. What would happen in post-industrial capitalism today if that was the basis of conducting commerce? This is a very popular song in the 1930s in the United States during the Great Depression. And I want to point out a particular stanza to the left, both in terms of its linkage to religious themes, but also in terms of views towards access of credit and debt. And that is, you work 16 tons in the coal mine, and what do you get? Another day older, deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, because I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. And this is really intriguing about this particular period of time in American capitalism, because here access to consumer credit was a form of social control. It was a way in which employers could impose labor discipline. You didn't repay your debts, you couldn't get any more credit, and of course this is a period without unemployment and other forms of social welfare compensations. So dependency on access to credit was critical for the survival of working class households. During the same period of time, the most popular board game in the world, translated into over 82 languages, is Monopoly. And what are the cultural values that it inculcates on young children playing the game? A long-term vision, investing, planning for the future, and if you play by the rules, you actually have to pay interest on the money that you borrow. And most intriguingly, those who lose have to publicly exclaim that they've gone bankrupt. Similarly, during the next decade, mobilization towards the war implied a degree of societal discipline that, in terms of contributing to the war effort, and we'll see the parallel that's so striking in the 2000s, is the emphasis that there's a limited amount of resources, we're in this together, and as a society, we are going to contribute either directly in the war effort through fighting or indirectly by containing our consumptive urges. So you notice there, this is a war bond stamp. And in fact, the same one here, in terms of mobilizing nationalist attitudes in the United States, you see at the bottom that this was an effort to popularize the purchase of war bonds. We fast forward to the emergence then of facilitating commerce after World War II. Where in the United States we began to see the dismantling of major cities, the phenomenon of suburban sprawl, the point being that people are conducting commerce who don't know each other. And the credit card becomes a very important, not just technological instrument in terms of facilitating commerce, but it becomes a way in which trust that before was a social relationship, now trust becomes commodified in this rationalized process where the credit card says this person is trustworthy, that the purchase will be paid for. And this is an example of the early first major credit card company in California, which was limited in the 1960s because of earlier restrictions based on concerns of the Great Depression era that banks were going to play with depositors' money. So credit cards in the early period of time were limited to within state boundaries, and this is very important as we explore the globalization of this financial service product. In fact, this is I like to show this one because this is clearly a point in time up to the 70s where you'd get a free toaster oven to open up an account in a bank, and in this case, what do you get also but to cement loyalty within the bank and the customer? You got a credit card. And in fact, to put it into even more clearer relief, consumer credit, whether it was informal between the merchant and the consumer based on trust, or as it became commodified and rationalized with some of the big corporations, those businesses did not make money on credit. And that's a key issue as we begin to explore what happens under post-industrialism. So the first big company that had its own credit card was Sears. And Sears, even though they charged 18% interest, given the labor intensivity of maintaining individual accounts, they generally lost money on their credit cards. So let's fast forward to contemporary period today. This is a marketing program by the Smithsonian Institution, certainly the icon, the most important repository of American culture and society, and in this case underscores the tension with neoliberalism, where the Smithsonian essentially sold itself as a brand. And notice at the bottom now how it uses that historical legacy of the old ethos presented by Benjamin Franklin, that now a penny saved is a penny earned, but now you can actually earn money by spending and consuming. And what's intriguing in here, not only that, but you're going to support a major important institution. Now, the credit card industry, as we'll see, understood that to encourage people to borrow and live beyond their means was to challenge heretofore critically important religious and societal taboos. And so what it had to do very early on was to associate itself with icons and institutions that were seen to be pure. So if the Smithsonian Institution can partner up with Discover Credit Card, there had to be a good reason. It must be okay. Credit cards that partner themselves with your university so that you'll have your own university credit card. Today, even large churches have their own credit cards where a portion of the proceeds go back to the co-sponsor. Here, what's interesting about the Smithsonian is if you do the economics, you actually get in present value a $25 bond, but at 19.9% interest, you would have spent several hundred dollars to qualify because it required $5,000 in charges. That's part of the new economics of the credit card nation. Wanted to throw this one in, again, in a humorous notion. This is from Los Angeles, but this marketing was an effort to maintain a connection. You know, that historically all cultures are shoppers and consumers, and gee, no matter where we go, we're going to find an opportunity to consume. And here, of course, you shop us till you drop us. As I explored the popular culture in the United States, I wanted to find when was the beginning of the glorification of consumer credit. And this was the very first movie whose sole focus was on consumer credit cards. This came out in about 1978. And what's intriguing is that since less than a third of Americans even had credit cards, and those who did had very high incomes, the presentation of credit cards in this movie was, this is a new novel device, and it's what I call the cognitive disconnect. It meant that people didn't understand the use of leveraging your future income through credit versus the standard of living that you have based on a cash-only society. So in this movie, people saw plastic as this once wonderful instrument that could do things that only those special elite people had access to. But for the masses, we didn't qualify for consumer credit. We go 10 years later, the cult movie Rosalie Goes Shopping, which is by the same producers of the Beautiful Laundrette. And this is very intriguing because in this movie it shows that in the consumer culture, that's out of control. Those people who survive are those who can creatively and sometimes illegally use consumer credit, where the key theme of this movie is if you owe the bank $100,000, it's your problem. If you owe the bank $1 million, it's the bank's problem. And that brings us up to the early 90s of this movie, which was based on the average middle-class American household, where consumer credit and debt was stereotypically based on the problem being individualized, that those people who were heavily in debt were those people who could not temper their consumptive urges. And this is critical because as we link the popular culture to what's going on in larger trends in society, this is a period in the United States and globally of major industrial restructuring. Millions, a million people a year in the United States were losing their job in the 1980s with the contraction of manufacturing and blue-collar industries. So what's particularly intriguing is the disconnect emerging in the 1990s between who's in debt and why, and particularly because of what I've discussed as a moral divide, that this old cultural ethos that being out of debt is good and what it should be, one should strive for, and being in debt is bad, that the financial service industry then, by unleashing this tremendous amount of new credit throughout mainstream society, is basically saying, if you got into debt, you play, you pay. And it's your fault for getting into debt, knowing, as I'll show in a moment, that the people who are now getting credit in debt were people who had been previously denied and who now, with the contraction of the American welfare state, found consumer credit as their final social safety net. I don't know if this game was popular in Europe, but I counterpose this game with the values of monopoly. This mall madness game, and if you can see at the top, it comes with the easy money credit card. And interestingly enough, in monopoly, you win by amassing the most wealth. In this game, you win by amassing the most consumer items that you can purchase in the mall. And in fact, how do you save money in this game? This is primarily targeted to young girls, teenage girls. Do you go and work extra? Do you ask for an allowance from mom and dad? No, you run to the automatic teller machine, and it randomly offers different amounts of money. And the way to save money versus earn money through investment in this game is to rush to a sale so that your money actually goes further. So the person who comes back to the parking lot with the most toys literally wins this game. Now, I've gotten a lot of criticism with my work on college students and credit card marketing, where the industry says, well, we don't understand what his problem is about marketing to 17 and 18-year-olds. After all, in America, children are objects of mass marketing for consumerism at the age of 3. And I was kind of taken back on that because I hadn't actually examined marketing towards 3-year-olds. But lo and behold, 2 years ago, this new Barbie toy came out. And I don't know if you can see in the back, but it's designed to be marketed for children 3 years and up. And this is literally a facsimile of a real cash register. It sounds like you're processing the credit card just as you're leaving the retailer. So yes, indeed, our attitudes and how we're socializing young children towards credit has come to the point that that piece of plastic has become magical because now of the cognitive disconnect of people who get credit before they get their first job. Now, how many people, we see this today, where the dog and the cat, and even Chairman Greenspan in the United States said, the goldfish and the moose can get credit cards. And the reason, of course, is, as I'll show you, it's so profitable. You can afford to lose some money. And as I looked for some comparisons for my presentation today, it wasn't very hard to find one in the UK, and I have to say I have not found a pet that got this a level of credit in the United States. So we're still going to work on this one, 10,000 pounds. Even the Beanie Baby frenzy could not avoid being associated with credit cards. This is the MBNA Beanie Baby, where you shop and shop, so much to do, so little time, you're never through. But Time MasterCard will save the day because it's the easy way to pay. Notice that you're consuming. There's no question of how you're actually going to pay for it. That was largely oriented towards women and young girls. I had to find one that was socializing young boys. And this is a famous baseball player in the United States. And I found out in 1992 there was an entire baseball card set that was designed exactly like the magnetic strip technology of credit cards. And, of course, this is the newest marketing campaign, which is particularly annoying in the United States, where young children are supposed to constantly prod their parents to spend so they can get that free trip to Disney World. And we'll see this in another cross-cultural example in a moment. Had to throw in the Austin Powers card. And what really irks me about this one, this was actually marketed to people who attended the movie. And my understanding is that the industry spends, on average, somewhere between $120 to $170 for a new client. And if you notice what you got, you only get two small drinks. And I thought they could at least spring for large drinks on this one. But I guess the popularity of demonstrating your personal persona in the form of an Austin Powers credit card was so important that people would go for that particular option. Now, as we fast forward the new patriotism of spending and consuming in America, some recent work being done today about how the sense of mobilizing together as being part of the project of the post-war consumer society meant that in many ways, especially today in the United States under Homeland Security, we're giving up our civic and political rights for the joy and beauty of the democracy of consumption. And these were some of the marketing campaigns that occurred immediately after 9/11. Now, I want to show this in terms of, as we get to the next section, the generational distance that has emerged in this relatively short period of time. This is an advertisement for senior citizens retiring. And I like to think of this in terms of the Rolling Stones song. A generation that perceives consumption as an earned value and distinguishes between needs and wants. The ultimate goal of saving and being independent for maintaining one's household. So that's 30 years ago. This is pretty much summarizes this generational tension as you look at retirees 65 and older compared to people under 35 are more than twice as likely to report that they're paying off their credit cards. Now, I like to call the new generation of mass marketing of the just-do-it consumptionism, where consuming is not a privilege but an entitlement, which implies then that consumption occurs before you get your first job, the ability to understand how to manage a household budget. And this is really critical, and I know the debate is occurring here in the UK about marketing credit and the emergence of debt before young people get their first job. So I wanted to give you an example of how this is glorified in the United States with a hip-hop song. Notice the emphasis now is again back on this all flash, no cash. Preoccupation with consumerism and social status. So that's what you're missing in the U.S. So that's the first section of how quickly we've gone through this transformation cognitively and culturally through largely the unleashing of an extraordinary mass marketing campaign. From under $40 million in 1983, the advertising budget of the big four credit card companies in the United States approached $1 billion. And so the real question is, why did this happen when it happened? Why, if consumer credit cards are so profitable today, why weren't they marketed at an earlier period of time? So what I want to focus on in this section is how incredibly profitable credit cards and the deregulation of financial services have been. These are two credit cards that I've received in the last few years. You can probably guess which one I use. War or peace? It really doesn't matter. If it's a B-1 bomber that'll get you to use that credit card, they'll market it to you. If it's the 1972 peace and anti-war rally in Washington, D.C., and that gets you to use your consumer credit card, that's fine. Niche marketing has been taken to a new level in the United States in terms of marketing credit cards. And the emphasis now is that we're not embarrassed to use our credit cards, that in fact showing our credit cards demonstrates who we are as a consumer and as an individual. And in fact, in some of the other interviews I've done, some of my respondents, young respondents, have emphasized they don't even feel that they're important unless they're consumers, and nobody knows they're a consumer until they flash that gold credit card. Okay. So I want to show you this particular advertisement, which highlights to me the profound change of how the credit card industry has become marginalized to a core of the American culture. Now, then I'm going to go into the nitty-gritty of when and why it occurred. This is an advertisement during the 2000 Olympics that would never have been produced 2 decades ago. And I'm just going to let you see it real quick, and then we'll deconstruct it in a moment.
Sometime over commercialization and endless official sponsorship, it's nice to sit back and take a moment to simply marvel at the inherent beauty of Olympic sport. Okay, moment over. Visa, the only card accepted at the Olympic Games of the new millennium.
As this industry has become so powerful, and I should emphasize today that with President Bush's re-election campaign in full throttle, with spending at unprecedented levels, 8 of the top 10 contributors to his campaign are from financial services. That advertisement couldn't have happened, if you notice especially the self-parody. You know, hey, it's about nationalism. It's about rooting for people from your country. The purity, interesting irony, purity of amateur athletics, not tainted by money. And that here we can cheer for our boys and women. And then at the end, they can wink and say, but it's really about the money, right? We know that. Could never have gotten away with that a couple of decades ago. Oh, I'm sorry I didn't update this. I mean, how quickly do things change? This was 2002. Right. Let me tell you, right now, I was in a big debate about 3 years ago about how big the national deficit was going to explode, and it was only because of this low-interest policy that, of course, you're embracing here that kept it at manageable levels. The U.S. debt is now up to $6.7 trillion, and next year will be over $7 trillion. Corporate debt level is about 5.3, but consumer debt has jumped to almost $9 trillion. And I'll break that down for you in a minute. So when and why did all of this really happen? The big key is the pressures of globalization that are beginning to manifest themselves in the late 1970s. Wages in the United States, particularly industrial wages, peak in real terms after inflation in 1973. By the end of the 1970s, the pressure to dismantle things like interstate banking restrictions, the fear that big banks would come in and swallow up local banks and take their depositors' money away, and there'd be no investment available, no loans available for local communities, that started to break down, as well as what are called firewalls to prevent wholesale versus retail banking, the big scandals in Washington. And in this case, what we're referring to is the selling of securities and stocks and bonds, where if Citibank is loaning money to Chrysler, their representatives at Salomon Smith Barney shouldn't be touting the Chrysler stock because there's a conflict of interest. So what's emerging in the late 1970s is structural pressures on American households. And at the same time, we've got a third world debt crisis, which is really crimping the major national banks, particularly the major money center banks. Commercial real estate is deflating. Massive bankruptcies are erupting. The United States last year had an all-time record of 1.6 million bankruptcies, and that's close to 2% of American households. In the last decade, a tenth of American households have declared bankruptcy. Also, but most importantly in terms of the pressure for deregulation, corporate borrowers were no longer going to the big banks. They could go straight to the major financial institutions and float a bond and get their money much cheaper. Banks in 1980, you know, it's always that scenario of be worried of when you get what you wish for. The banks got deregulation, and suddenly they were in a big quandary. They lost the low cost of borrowers' money because depositor loans were so cheap, getting 5% interest during a period of inflation of 18%. So banks suddenly got what they wanted in the early 1980s and were losing money big time. In fact, between 1979 and 1981, Citibank lost over $400 million on its credit card business. The key point becomes 1982, and of course in 1980 when Ronald Reagan is elected, final assault on American unions, with the Air Traffic Controllers Union that is broken, but also the fixation here on monetary policy and inflation, getting down inflation from 20% down to 4%. And what that meant was, in real terms, consumers who have access to credit, it was rational for them to spend money they didn't have. So if they had a credit card at 20% and inflation was 20%, it was a good deal. But something happened when inflation went down to 4% and they're still spending 20% interest on their credit cards. So the bottom line is, the industry now is in disarray. It's trying to figure out what's going to be profitable, and the one shining light is retail or consumer financial services. So during this period of tremendous pressure of globalization on the American core manufacturing industries, the industry says, hey, wait a minute, we're making so much money on people with their credit cards, we got to figure out more people to loan money to at these interest rates. And for the first time in the mid-1980s, people are being offered credit cards who never had them before. Laid-off steel workers are getting credit cards. Middle-class America is getting credit cards, and they're using it to help deal with these tremendously difficult periods of structural change. And to just show you in the United States what it means in terms of income, notice that as recently as the mid-90s, real income in the United States was declining. In fact, you look at households in 1999, and they're finally getting to the point above the late 1970s. So there's this tremendous pressure now. There are more items being produced by this massive new regime of globalization, and you can see part of that in the first table that I gave to you, where the United States essentially becomes the core of global consumption. And you can see that reflected in terms of the last segment of balance of trade. I didn't want to overwhelm you with numbers, but the economists out there will notice that in terms of gross domestic product, the current account in the United States jumps from negative 1.4%, those should all be negatives, by the way, to negative 5.4%. So the mass marketing of consumer items in the United States becomes not just a national contribution to the well-being of society, it's also a contribution to the well-being of the global economy. This, I think, table that you have is probably most important in terms of the parallel with the UK. And what's critical here is the first column where you'll see between 1979 and 2001 the tremendous increase in the cost of housing. And this is really critical because, as you see in terms of disposable income, the huge surge between 79 and today. People are spending more for their houses, but they're not compensating by cutting back in other forms of consumption. Instead, what we're seeing is that the financial service industry in the United States and soon throughout the world is offering credit to buy literally anything, where now it's commonplace in the United States to borrow up to 125% on the value of your home. And, of course, with a low-interest policy, those homes are jumping up. In fact, if you look where it says home equity loans, this is borrowing a loan from the value of your home. That loan didn't even exist in 1990. And in fact, the number one reason people take out home equity loans is to pay off their credit cards. So here we have this real interesting comparison with the UK for a variety of very, very good reasons. Countries that don't have an industrial policy, the easy way to stimulate economic growth is to promote a view that your house is the best and secure asset you can get, and then you've got to buy bigger homes, and you've got to buy all this stuff to fill your homes with, and in the short term, that keeps the economy rolling. Now, I wanted to show you this example because there's been a lot of discussion of the wealth effect, that people buy and consume things because they are indeed wealthier. And in the United States, people tend to consume based on their perception of the future. Even if they're unemployed, if they think they're going to get a good job, they're more willing to purchase items and to get into debt. Well, as you can see from this chart, if you look at the bottom 40% and middle 20%, that's average median American households, overwhelmingly, most Americans during the peak period of appreciation of stock market portfolio wealth in America didn't accumulate net wealth. The real story in the United States was the accumulation of debt, that the real beneficiaries of, and the reason the United States has the most unequal distribution of wealth in the industrialized world, meant that the top 10% and especially the top 1% were the beneficiaries of this amount of wealth that was created. For the average American, there wasn't net wealth created, and for them it meant assuming more levels of debt. And for those economists out there, know that a Gini coefficient, as it inflection point in it, rises sharply, it means there's greater inequality. So on the one hand, at a consumption level, we're seeing more equality. People can have a DVD player. But in terms of the fundamentals of the society, they're paying for it at an increasingly high cost. And of course, these are the beneficiaries of the transformation of the American economy. And let's look at it in more concrete terms in a moment. And this is actually highlights the incredible disjuncture of inequality in the United States, where you actually see unemployment going down when bankruptcies are going up in America. The top three reasons Americans declare bankruptcy are high medical expenses, a job loss, or a personal crisis such as a divorce. Now, the banking industry has been planning this takeoff for quite some time. This is an extraordinary image for me from what was one of the most important popular middle-class magazines in the 1960s and 70s. This is dated 1970, when outstanding credit card debt in America was less than $10 billion. So there was a plan. Now let's look at how it came out. And how many people spend to get those frequent flyer miles? I had to throw this one in because it reflects the soaring image here of consumer credit and debt. This is credit card debt in America today. As recently as 1980, it was less than $50 billion. What I presented here is on the right-hand side is installment debt. On the left-hand side of each year, it's credit card debt. The point being is that when we had a regime of borrowing based on pay-as-you-go, you buy $1,000 worth of furniture, you pay 6%, you pay it off, you got an asset. That was the old way of conducting business. Under the deregulated environment, the best customer is not someone who can pay it off, it's someone who will never pay it off. Then this huge shift now, increasingly where more and more people are shifting to high-cost revolving credit where they don't even remember what they paid for it and the things they have bought have already worn out. So key issues have occurred. I want to present this table as I rush through here quickly. The collection of information on debt, consumer debt, is very, very poor. On average, national governmental surveys underestimate credit card debt by between 45 and 55%. And I also wanted to show you this table because this is an analysis that we did of a survey of consumer finance in America, and it shows you how as the credit card industry was saturating traditional markets, it began expanding into more marginal markets. I would assume only in America can you expect a 70-year-old who's been retired for many years could get a 30-year mortgage for a couple $100,000 for a home. You can see that reflected as the fastest growth of consumer credit card debt is among the working poor and senior citizens. Both, of course, who have suffered with the dismantling and contraction of the American welfare state. Two key trends that have emerged then as a product of this is consolidation and conglomeration. In 1977, the top 50 banks in America controlled about half of the credit card market. And as I'll show you in a moment, today the top 10 control almost 85%. These are three different credit card companies that reflect popular marketing on college campuses today, and they're actually all three owned by the same bank, Citibank. Now, these are the top 10 credit card companies today. And in fact, many of us have been saying there probably will only be six or seven major players. The industry emphasizes there's 6,000 issuers. And in fact, already, just since we were out of the country, Frank, J.P. Morgan is merging and acquiring Bank One, and another major bank, Fleet, has been purchased by Bank of America as well. So what we're seeing here is this tremendous amount of cash flow that's being produced by consumer credit cards is helping to fuel and to serve almost as collateral for the purchases of banks that's leading to these mega global banks of the first trillion-dollar bank in the United States. It's also led to some very interesting changes in terms of our lexicon towards consumer credit and debt. Again, I want to bring back to the point of what I call the moral divide. you're in debt, work of the devil, got to get you on the straight and narrow and discipline yourself to learn how to avoid temptation. Deadbeats in America were typically referred to as people who couldn't honor their debts. And I ask people today, who's the deadbeat? And from the banking industry, it's those people who pay off their debts because they don't make any money off them. And this is a table to show you indeed how on the one hand, the industry is using the individual decision to stay out of debt as a reason that it raises the cost of credit for those who can't get out of debt. But on the other hand, as people have learned how to play the system and it's a free loan, internally they're very resistant. They're trying to figure out how in the world we get them to pay their way. So essentially now in the credit card nation, you've got poor people subsidizing rich people. Now here's the key point. Since 1982, with inflation under control and some very important regulatory changes have occurred, I've argued that in real terms, the cost of borrowing on credit cards has increased about threefold in America. And in fact, with the Supreme Court decision in 1996, there's no longer even a cap on fees. And since 1996, just the revenues from fees on credit cards in America have risen from 1.3 to over $9 billion. And we can get to that in a discussion later. And it shouldn't surprise us then, there's a lot of money involved, not just for the industry as a whole, which has recorded over 10% pre-tax profit growth during a recession in the United States. I'll just show you that real quickly. What I've called the sticky interest rates have emerged, that when the cost of borrowing goes up, the banks have no problem raising it. But as we've reached this historic low in the cost of borrowing, there's been a floor raised or established, and interest rates aren't getting any lower. That helps to explain why these record profits are emerging. And I don't want to get into it in too much depth right now, but in the debt industry today, many of you don't realize that your debt is being resold on the secondary market and might even be fueling your parents' or grandparents' retirement fund. That's a pretty scary scenario. As you can see here, for CEOs of credit card companies, it's incredibly lucrative. Had to throw this one in, particularly with the discussions here today of consumer debt among college students and a lot of attention that I've gotten on my work. The key is here, there's been kind of a Maginot line crossed. 18 in the United States is when you are held accountable for your personal debts. A bank can give a 16-year-old a credit card, but it can't make them repay the debt. The key point here is this ethos and the transformation towards consumer credit, where one earned the privilege to borrow on future earnings, has now been turned upside down in the consumer economy. That consumer credit is a middle-class entitlement, and you can use it at an earlier and earlier age. That it's your right. In fact, in the marketing of credit cards and the multi-million dollar exclusive contracts with universities in the United States, you constantly hear this resonant theme that the best investment you're going to make is on your college education, and that you do have a full-time job. You're just not getting paid for it. So what's the big deal about getting in debt? You're at the beginning of your earnings curve, and you're going to make all this money, and everything's going to be just fine. So I just want to show you some of the marketing. When I was teaching at Georgetown University, lo and behold, they shouldn't have done this, but the first page of the schedule of classes was marketing for credit cards. I found this to be the most egregious marketing for those of you who have children. This was the, for many reasons, the worst marketing, but most importantly, it plays upon parental authority relations. You know, why do you need to have to ask mom and dad for money to go away on a trip or buy clothes? You got Uncle Citibank or Aunt Chase, and they can give you the money, and it's just going to be between the two of you. And also, in terms of duplicitous marketing, it says 3% cash back. You only get that cash back if you're paying 22% interest and carrying a balance. Now, how many of you get these overnight express mailings? Looks pretty important, right? Well, how can you imagine an 18-year-old getting this, and it's just an advertisement for a credit card? And indeed, probably the most successful marketing campaign in America has been the MasterCard campaign about, you know, there are some things money can't buy, for everything else there's MasterCard. Here, what the industry has been very effective on is ironically turning on its head the importance of non-monetary relationships, and that there are some social relationships that you can't put a price tag on, and consumer credit and its easy access becomes a facilitator for that fabulous vacation in Tahiti that's going to have lifelong memories. But of course, they never give you a refund if it actually rains that week and you can't afford to repay it. I would have shown you the Simpsons clip where Bart gets his first credit card, but time doesn't permit. But it's extraordinary how accurate it is that between occupant of a household or a college student, anybody today is fair game, whether they can afford it or not. So I want to run through real quickly some things to look out for from a consumer perspective. We've noticed today that plastic, has anyone ever seen a black American Express card, by the way? Do you know what you have to do to get a black card? You have to charge a minimum of $150,000 a year. So most of us don't get access to black cards. But what is intriguing is how in the consumption culture, people have been proud to show that they're worthy of a gold card or a platinum card or another exclusive card. And this was really important to the industry because at the beginning, the cultural attitudes were that if you had to borrow money, you had somehow not maintained your household finances very well. So affluent people didn't want to get lumped together with lower income people. And that's why they had to have these different status cards of the gold card and the platinum card, etc. This, of course, lays bare the status distinctions because all it meant was that you could get further and further in debt. Now, this is the oxymoron. Kmart in the United States is kind of the bottom tier marketer, and a famous comedian said that the marketing campaign of this Kmart gold card should be as a takeoff of the American Express card. Don't leave your trailer park without it. Don't leave your poor home. I thought that was pretty cruel. Now, I want to show you, this is a credit card statement of First USA Bank One, one of the top five credit card companies in the United States. The industry standard has been that your repayment would be 2%. But what they haven't told you is you always assume that that 2% is going to pay the principal. As you can see, the minimum payment here is $100, in this case dollars. The finance charges are $112. Here you have negative amortization. People feel that they can afford to spend, but if they actually send in the minimum payment, they'll never come close to paying off their debts. I want to show you some of the flashy advertising real quick here. The Diamond Card, gee, standard, gold, platinum, diamond must be better, right? Well, read the fine print, because you'll see that the interest rate can go up here to 35%. It's always important to read the fine print. I'll show you a couple of others. This is a high-status gold card. Sounds good, but if you look in the middle at the top, it says grace period. How long you have before the interest accrues if you don't carry a balance? Zero. How many people read this fine print? Now, in terms of disclosure, I need to say that I'm an expert witness on this particular class action lawsuit. This is a particularly duplicitous company, and they market to people with distressed credit, and as they're having financial problems. And notice it says fixed 9.9%, which isn't bad for credit card standards. But when you apply for it, it costs $178 in fees to get it, and you only get $350. So you're actually going to get only $172, but you're only going to pay 9.9% on it. Okay. So, again, how are we beginning to assess what is the credit card industry and how straightforward they are? FDIC is really important in America because these are the major federal banking system and all your deposits are insured. So somebody with distressed credit gets this and thinks, oh, I'm worthy. That sounds pretty good. And I'm probably the only one who actually reads this kind of fine print. Guaranteed to get $400 in credit. And when you add up all the charges, you're going to end up with $31 in credit. It comes out to $369 in fees. The new variant of getting people into the mainstream is if there's no way you've ruined your credit, you're going to get any access to it, you actually set up a savings account and you borrow from yourself through the use of a credit card. So it kind of helps you get back into the mainstream and you're not stigmatized that you can't have a credit card, but you're getting charged 20% interest to borrow money from yourself. Not a bad deal. This is probably the one that really I feel so sorry for people because this is a credit offer, but you can only buy their products, and they're usually pretty crummy. And people that are really desperate for credit will get this and pay $60 and think they're going to run out and get a cash advance and pay their rent, and they're going to find out that it's only for that particular mail order company. This is just a summary for people that are interested, and I encourage you to go to my website for some of my congressional testimonies. But this basically summarizes the dismantling of consumer protections in America and how consumer credit and debt has increased so much. And if there's interest, I'll be happy to go over systematically how the balance has shifted from local and state regulation to federal regulation, which basically means no regulation. Now, let's conclude. One of the final key issues about the deregulation of financial services is the emergence of a bifurcated system. At the high extreme level, deregulation has been great, low cost, easy money. Middle class, heavily indebted, access to credit at a higher cost. It's for the people at the next tier. These are people that are paying 600, 700, 800% interest, and that there's a linkage between the first tier banks who are indirectly benefiting financially through the expansion of these other kinds of companies, which I'm sure some of you have heard of, things like pawn shops and rent-to-own stores, cash checking stores, etc. And I just want to highlight this and show you some extreme examples based on my field work, but this is the cost of credit for people who supposedly under deregulation were going to get lower cost interest. And in fact, you're seeing things like payday loans that could charge as much as 30% for a two-week loan. This is a new trend. Is this in the UK? Where you actually get your money, it's loaned to you when you prepare your taxes, and it's given to you immediately, and they'll charge like 10%, which is equivalent of a two-day loan. This is a typical pawn shop where you're actually borrowing money on an asset, but this is the one, and boy, they would not let me go here. This was in a middle-class African-American neighborhood, and this is a contract to lease money. Think about it. You're going to lease money, and it's collateralized with three forms of electronic equipment, a stereo, a computer, a television, and it still comes out to an annual interest rate of almost 800%. This is what's become increasingly popularized with, you know, 1.6 million households declaring bankruptcy. This is John Madden, a real famous football coach and announcer in the United States. Some of you might be familiar with him. His annoying voice is almost everywhere. And he's giving credibility to this industry. This marketing campaign was critical because it basically gave credibility to charging usurious rates to the middle class for consumer items, particularly those who couldn't get them. And I show this just as an example. This was some field work that I did. Look at the same item being sold in an electronic store with their high interest credit card with the terms of 78 weeks. That $196 television cost $231. In the rent-to-own store over 78 months, it would cost almost $780. And that's how extraordinary now the nature of inequality is in the United States in terms of access to cash, to the point now that many of the leading retailers don't make money selling things. They make money financing them. And you see this all the time, and I love this one being promoted by the American Dream, where 12 months is the same as cash. Well, notice the asterisk now because we've sued them. 12 months is not the same as cash because if you don't pay it off within that period of time, all the interest is retroactive. That's what's making money for the biggest retailers today. And we see it increasingly mainstream. So I want to then end in terms of global expansion today. What do we see about consumer financial services? Massive consolidation of the industry. Consolidation now is assuming a different form where retail and wholesale banking now are in the same institution, where you have insurance, institutional financing, you've got stocks and bonds, mortgage companies, as well as consumer finance, all in one company with huge conflicts of interest that are fundamentally eroding consumer privacy, which I don't have time to get into. What's critical is that this high cost of credit, which has been the motor for economic growth in the United States and minimizing status distinctions, has become critical now to the motor of global growth. And as markets in the United States have become saturated, the major global banks, as they're emerging and consolidating, are trying to figure out how they can begin to expand globally. This is a credit card from last week in Japan. where you see again now global banks seeing the world how to market consumer credit. And in fact, if you look at this particular table, credit card charges in the United States have not only stagnated, but the rate of growth is going down. The rate of growth globally of consumer credit charges with credit cards is about 3 times greater than it is in the United States. The ability of the United States to be the core of sustaining a free trade regime is soon reaching its, has reached its apex, and will have to begin to shift to other centers of the world as a site for consumption. So this is really critical. In the short term, the industry has responded by creating all these smart technological cards, and as well as debit cards, where people now are using a credit card to buy a soda, to go to the grocery store and buy things for a pound. Of course, that could not have occurred a decade ago. But that's just a short-term solution. The key is now the partitioning of the global market through the use of consumer credit. Had to throw this one in, too. Would you believe that Twiggy is being used to encourage Japanese to sign up for credit cards? You can actually get your own Twiggy credit card in Japan. But let's go to this one really epitomizes the crisis of Japan, of trying to get Japanese to consume more to get the economy going again. In other words, one of the big issues about global financial services is this little impediment called cultural resistance, that simply offering people credit doesn't mean that you can get them into debt. But easy credit is the key. So here's what I was able to dig up for our presentation about what consumer credit expansion means in Europe. And number one, obviously there's huge differences. As you saw in the very first table, the savings rate decline both in the UK and the United States is very similar. What's really intriguing here is that as consumer credit expands, the question is, how accessible is it to different parts of Europe and to different social groups in Europe? So as you can see, the UK is right up there in terms of average aggregate consumer credit growth, but part of it, of course, is an extension of the huge increase in mortgages. I'm playing with the parallel of countries like Germany, where in France, about how the contraction of the welfare state is involuntarily forcing people to take on more consumer debt, and we'll see how that turns out. Again, constant now emphasis in Japan of encouraging people to get into consumer credit and debt. So here really becomes a summary table on expansion of consumer credit in Europe. And notice the substantial takeoff in the last 10 years. Wages, the problem and the contradiction of neoliberalism as a trade regime is, on the one hand, to keep wages as low as possible, to keep taxes for corporations as low as possible, which means that publicly subsidized costs that households could use to depend on is no longer available. So to continue the growth of the consumer economy, that means you have to expand effective demand among the citizenry. And if we're assuming more costs for health and housing and other social services, there's not enough money left over to consume. That's why there's such a critical effort in the deregulation of global consumer services. Under the World Trade Organization, there's actually a separate component called the General Agreement of Trade and Services. And doing research on that, I found that the leading countries in terms of promoting deregulation of financial services globally are, not surprising, the United States and the UK. And this, of course, becomes critical in terms of mobilizing consent and support within democratic regimes, in terms of maintaining high levels of aggregate growth to keep the motors and engines of the economy growing, and also to incorporate and absorb this massive volume of commerce that's being created in developing countries. And now, for the first time, many of those developing countries are actually being incorporated as both producers and as consumers through the magic of plastic. Leads us to this final table of the white paper on consumer debt in the EU. And what was extraordinary to me is that this is presaging the future. The first column is simply a self-report by country. And you have the abbreviations of countries in your handout, so I don't want to go over all of those. But what's critical here is, in terms of the self-report, you see distress emerging. But these are households that are differentiated by whether they have mortgage debt or not. And when you go to the other table, it's basically asking, are you having problems paying your debt if you have a loan other than a mortgage? And what you see is this huge surge now in financial distress. And what it's really telling me is that as banks feel more comfortable loaning money to people who are willing to repay, what's extraordinary about the U.S. experience is not that during the recession almost 5% couldn't pay their credit card bills, it's that 95% of them did. And that's what's going to be intriguing about the new credit regime in Europe, is that as different forms of credit become available and the debt burden increases, then we're going to see distress. But if debt is limited simply to getting a mortgage for your home and some degree of debt on credit cards, it will be manageable. But what this table is telling us is as we expand unsecured loans, that people's ability to repay becomes exponentially more difficult. So it's on that note that on the credit card nation, first country that actually translated my book was in Korea, which right now is going through a tremendous crisis of promoting growth through consumer consumption, growing itself out of the global recession that way, which has now collapsed, versus traditional export production. And that leads us then to consumer credit and debt. Good or bad, how you use it is ultimately up to you. Thank you.